Welcome to the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We'll talk to fellow entrepreneurs and share stories of success, failures, and epic failures in the quest to understand the business, art, and science of the indie revolution in the city of big shoulders.
All right, and this is another episode of the Chicago Gamepreneur Show. I'm Kiwon Hong with my co-host Rob Lockhart.
Hi.
And we've got a special guest today. Tom, would you want to just do the brief introduction?
Sure, I'm Tom Eastman, the president of Trinket Studios. I previously to that worked at Wide Load Disney and made some okay games and then quit with two of my friends.
Very cool. That seems to be a trend these days. A lot of people
absolutely
going from the big to the small. if you hear any barking in the background, we actually have a couple special co-hosts with us today.
Yeah, we have Shelley and Watson, who are Indy City Co-op office dogs, just hang out with us all day.
Yeah, we are recording from the Indy City Co-op. We've been kind enough to lend us a little space to do the podcast today. So anyway, Tom, thanks for that quick intro. Maybe you could give us a little idea about what you've been doing recently.
Sure. So Trinket started off making two mobile games, and very quickly when deciding what to do next, we didn't want to make more mobile games. 99 cents has not been particularly good to us. So we really quit.
Not
our,
totally unkind, though.
Yeah, like medium kind. Slightly kind. We quit our jobs to make something cool that we were really proud of, mm-hmm. And it's hard to be more than a little proud of mobile games.
That's
so
fair.
So we went straight for a medium title that has turned into a very large title for three people.
I think that happens, right? You start with your feature set, and then somehow, like in the middle of the night, you give it water and it kind of starts going.
Yeah, so the idea is Battle Chef Brigade.
Mogwai game
developer. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So the game is Battle Chef Brigade, and the core concept was just sort of fantasy Iron Chef. We're going to mix a cooking competition with fantasy elements. So you could have flame swords that both are useful to attack things in, you know, typical fantasy ways, but also for like searing meat while cutting it. And we thought that a lot of the like orcs and elves and humans each having their own cuisines and stuff like has just been totally unexplored properly. So we thought that was like a really, really solid concept. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, you add some water and things happen. And pretty soon, we are kind of being led around by the idea and not by the tiny size of our team. With three people, it's easy to let the game idea take over. And so we've pared some of it down, but it's still a pretty big game where we want to have multiple characters, each with their own campaign. And we've been cutting back on some things like definitely no multiplayer and definitely no AI, but it's still a lot of work.
Yeah, it always is. It's interesting that you're taking that the food and fantasy approach, because I remember, you know, when I was growing up, I read a lot of the Redwall books, and those books, they're about half about food, you know? It is fantasy, but half of it's food. And I think a lot of the fantasy series, if you look at, you know, Lord of the Rings, there's a lot of the food is a rich part of the culture in there.
Yeah, so it's usually examined only from the perspective of, like, the heroes are eating the food now. And there's often, or I can't think of any good examples of where the heroes are involved in making it or go to the kitchen. It's like, use this magical item or food that's good for you. But it's never like, they're not examining, like, how was this grain made or something? Like, who is making this food? It's like, oh, there's some awesome kitchens in the back and someone did it and we're just going to eat it and become more powerful. And so we wanted to examine, like, the battle chefs in our game are warriors who are extremely adept at hunting monsters, killing them, taking the ingredients and making something delicious. And as part of the lore, that's important that there are, like, very dangerous monsters and you have to go out in the woods and the only thing you can eat are these monsters. So you have to be able to kill them and make delicious dishes that give you more power.
Very interesting. Do you cook at all?
Yeah, absolutely. I think the game kind of matched a lot of our own personal growth. Like, going indie in particular, you're like, all right, I can't exactly spend much money on food. So grocery stores and making your own food becomes much more important. And like, it's the time of your life where you're like, okay, I should start eating a little more healthily.
Yes, yeah, out of college. Definitely got to that point, yeah.
Got to start avoiding the pizza and
you can only eat so much ramen, right?
Exactly. So I think it was absolutely the right point. And then, yeah, so I cook a lot. And Eric's our artist, and Eric and I were roommates for a few years, and we really, like, pushed each other to learn some new dishes. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, I think it was always important. But the idea came up because during lunches, trinket lunches, back when we were just in our apartment, Eric would sometimes put on the Food Network on TV.
There we go.
And it was one time after brainstorming on Lake Michigan, we came back and we're like exhausted. We hadn't come up with anything good. And then we turn on Food Network and we're like, you know what? No one's on a good cooking game. And there are a lot of things about, like, cooking shows that mm-hmm. have just been terribly represented in games. Like Cooking Mama or Cook Serve Delicious are both good games and they've done really well. Mm-hmm. But they tell you what to make. They tell you a process to do it and you just do it. And, like, if you're making an omelet and cooking it, like, it tells you, now waggle the Wiimote like this. Now press these buttons in this order. Or Cook Serve Delicious is more like you have to do these certain inputs, and it's more like DDR or something. Okay. But in these cooking shows like Chopped or Iron Chef, it's all about the creativity and figuring out ways to mix ingredients mm-hmm. in unique ways, but it will still be delicious. And so our goal was to create a creative cooking game that you just weren't told what to make every time. And of course, that's kind of a challenge because you can't eat or taste your screen or smell your screen. And
yeah,
so true. A lot of that, the...
And scoring creativity.
Yeah, is extremely difficult. So it's finding what boundaries and constraints we can set for the design that make it so that you know what you're doing. You're not just mixing random things and you have an idea of what you're doing.
So it kind of feels like that's kind of a built-in crafting system, right? You've got yeah. items with attributes, and the way you combine them, you know, it kind of builds its own system in itself.
Yeah, yeah. And so, at the start, we were like, we don't want it to just be a crafting system. So it's finding, like, what aspects of crafting systems can fit into the kind of cooking mold to make it sensible and feel like those shows without, you know, just being... add random things, like bake random things and chop up some things and put them all together and see what you get.
So I had a question about the visual part of it. For me, there's an aspect of cooking, the plating, which I'm very bad at. But some people are very good at, right? They can they can take something and make it look even more delicious through the visual presentation. Is there a visual presentation aspect of the game, or is it kind of like, you know, their preset comes out like this?
Yeah, so that's one of the things that we've been discussing lately, and it's one of the things that we're probably going to push till after the Kickstarter.
That's fair.
Because, like, we've been calling them, like, the factory versions of things. Like, right now, you can have a main ingredient, like, you get a dragon shank or something, and you can sauce it or season it or garnish it, but the way each of those works is very generic. Like, if you sauce... some bowl ribs, the sauce texture gets applied in the same way. Mm-hmm. So, like, you can have different colored sauces, but it looks generally like it's not like, or garnishes is maybe a better example, that it just, like, places it in front of the dish.
I guess.
Whereas, like, if you're garnishing, like, with a green onion on a certain dish, you might, like, put a little sprig on top kind of thing, but other ones you might want, like, multiple in the front on the plate or something. And saucing too, there's like drizzling and of like really drenching something or a glaze, and getting the game to the point where we feel like those things are being represented nicely without the interface being extremely complicated.
Yeah.
Like, you get a liquid and it's like, here's 30 options. Like, that would be terrible. But being able to represent all of those things visually is really important. So we're trying to find that, like, balance between like those manufactured dishes and the, like, combinatorial explosion of plating options.
Right.
And so I think we're leaning towards letting Eric, our artist, making us some sort of editor that takes some of the more, like, powerful dishes that are worth more points. The, like, complexity points is how we're kind of turning a whole bunch of systems into just one score.
Okay.
Taking the more complex ones and giving them a cool representation, whereas, like, a simple 5-point dish will just be the generic factory version.
Mm-hmm. How's Kickstarter going? You mentioned it. I've seen little bits show up on your Twitter here and there.
Yeah, we've started planning, and we just today had a big planning meeting we trying to figure out like how far away it is, what sort of tiers we should have, what are like big branding pillars, what's our elevator pitch, and I think we're getting closer to the Kickstarter aspect will be doable, and I think we're gonna go for somewhere like 25 to 30,000 range.
Mm-hmm.
Especially after seeing Rob's awesome Kickstarter. But figuring out where the demo needs to be, we're not thinking of releasing the demo with the Kickstarter, mm-hmm. but we haven't had a chance to play test a lot so far. So we're hoping to like do some play tests and have a really solid build to take footage of and to like increase our own confidence in the design that we're presenting.
Mm-hmm.
So we're trying to like make both of those things happen very soon, so that we can get to the Kickstarter and feel really good about it and be really confident in what we're showing.
So, like, I imagine you'd want to spread that demo around to like press and YouTubers and
yeah, having a good demo is really important. It seems like did you release your demo to press?
Yes.
You did? Okay. Yeah, I think it'll be at a state where we could do that, but it's still really scary. Like, it would be great to follow in the footsteps of extremely successful Kickstarters that didn't do anything. They just showed gameplay, and then there was no demo. There was no people talking during it. And I don't think we're at that level. And I think we will, like, present ourselves and the project really briefly to give it some of that personal touch. But I guess we're all kind of, like, leery of giving them a demo when we represented the game so slightly misleading. Like,
you're representing what the game will be.
Yeah, exactly, exactly. And so, I don't know what I think about that. Like,
we kind of did different approaches. So for my Kickstarter, I just put it out there. And it wasn't like close to baked, right? I was like, I'm gonna put it out there just to show that I'm capable of doing what I said I was doing. Which I think was something that helped backers. Whereas something like Rob's, he had really great gameplay. And that gameplay footage, I think, really was strong in telling people, like, oh, yeah, kids can play this. They're going to enjoy it. So I don't think it's necessary to have the, like, a playable demo.
Yeah.
But I would say that, you know, half of Kickstarter, like, half is getting people excited about what you're doing. And the other half is basically getting them to be confident that you can do it.
Yeah.
So whether that's, you know, showing video or doing a demo, I think
if those are the two goals, then we're going to have lots of gameplay footage from the demo in the video. And then the other part is like Eric is going to create basically cartoon animations for a lot of the things, like introducing the different characters. And that worked really well for us. I mean, we don't have much to compare it to, but for Color Sheep and Orion's Forge, they each had like...
These were the two mobile games.
Yeah, those are the two mobile games we made. Mm-hmm. And the trailers were each about half like a little cartoon. And I think those did extremely well. It certainly set us apart from like, if games have that sort of thing, it's either pixel art or it's like a big studio with 3D cutscenes or something. Mm-hmm. And so like 2D illustrated cartoony sort of things are pretty rare. And I think that's going to work again for us.
Yeah, I saw a little of the art up on your Twitter, and it's gorgeous.
Yeah,
it
is
very
phenomenal.
It's like super distinctive too, right? It has a very like anime quality to it, which really like it is, as you said, rare to have like that kind of detail and hand drawn stuff.
Yeah, it seems like indies are very likely to just do pixel art.
Do we want to put like a percentage on it? I feel like 85% of games are pixel art.
Yeah, 2D indie games are. It's like
overwhelmingly.
Yeah, overwhelmingly pixel art. Which like has some very big advantages. and some of those are especially clear when you're making this sort of game. Like we can't get away with characters carrying something by having it float in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's important to like have their hands on it, and like just stuff like that is like, oh, that's some new systems that we're gonna need. Whereas like Spelunky or something like that, just like shove it in front of them and it floats and
During the process of my game, I bumped up from, I think, you could say roughly like 16-bit to 32-bit, and all of a sudden I was like, oh no, fingers! I have to worry about fingers now!
Yeah, and I guess the other style, if games aren't pure pixel art, then they're going to be for 2D indie games, then it's puppetry. And so we maybe could have done that, but Eric is gung-ho about doing awesome
puppetry is where you have like pieces like a paper cut out.
Yeah, like marionette style.
Just for non
which works really well, especially like if that's part of the style. Like if you've got a sort of papery flat style. But if you once you have
for, like,
shaded
don't
characters.
Starve,
yeah,
it works
don't starve
super well.
It does super well. And it's really appealing, and it's like the art style fits it. Mm-hmm. But we didn't want to do that. I mean, Eric is our art director. Whatever he says goes. Ben's the other programmer on the team. Ben and I often joke that our business model is just getting Eric's artwork out there. Because he's really, really good.
Let people give you money.
Yeah, if we could figure out a way to just like release a slideshow of his art, then probably the best game possible for us.
I mean, good art is definitely important in a Kickstarter. I think Rob did a great job with his animated GIFs.
Likewise, I mean, you've got some like rendered 3D stuff that looks awesome.
Yeah, so I mean, I think you're on a very good path with your art assets.
Thanks.
In terms of convincing people that it's going to be an awesome game. So, in terms of art style, I feel that just picking a style and sticking with it is the most important thing. A lot of people, you know, mess this up, right? They'll start with the style and then start like, they're like, oh, we can do this, and all of a sudden it looks disjointed, right? And you'd be better off just sticking with like the first style as long as everything was consistent. Mm. So it's good that you have an art director and someone just be like, this is the way I do things.
Yeah, like I really don't understand how Eric is so powerful, but he will just be like, here is a whole bunch of characters. They're amazing. And like, we'll just see them and be like, yes, I love all of them.
And you have some other people helping with out with art, though.
Yeah, this is the first project where we actually have contractors, which has been really nice. And the two of them are Eric. Well, for the art side, are two of Eric's college friends who are like have full time art jobs, but are willing to help out Eric out because he's awesome.
Have you had any problems with like the coherence of like making the styles match?
Absolutely, we've had a little bit, like the grass in the environments. So one of the artists is doing the background environments, and another one is helping with coloring animations because that's a huge task.
Yep.
And we've had some conflicts about like Eric's plant style. He draws plants very organically, and his friend draws them a little differently, and so. So that can take a lot of time, like trying to merge those two to fit the game. And it's always hard when someone is producing something that looks really good but might not work for the specific purpose that we need it in. Like, if he's looking at his Photoshop file, it's perfect. But when we bring it into the game, like, oh, that blade of grass is going to look weird because her foot is going to be in between it or something.
Right.
And we don't want to have to layer that grass. So, like, that sort of thing, and that back and forth can be...
I think it's the mark of a good contractor when you can give them like constructive feedback and they're like, okay, that's good feedback.
I understand.
Because I feel terrible. Like, I worked with contractors and I had a guy maybe just last week turning something that like I could tell like a lot of work into it, but it just didn't match the style I was looking for. So I sent it back to him and he was like, oh yeah, thanks for the, you know, the style up there. I was like, oh, such a relief. I felt so bad, you know, going like, you know, I know you put
let me put a red circle on that.
Yeah, apparently George Lucas like has a stamp. He literally goes around and like stamps things as like, no, we're not going to use this, or yes, this is going to be the next Star Wars movie.
Nice.
Yeah, for like episodes 1, 2, 3.
That seems like a good way though to really do it quickly. Like if you have a lot of money, just make a lot of people make a lot of work, and then you just be like, yes, no, yes, no, yes, no, make a movie.
Except the things he said yes to were like General Lucas and Jar Jar Binks.
Did you get the stamps?
So it's it's only as good as the guy wielding the stamps.
Yeah.
But how are you paying for contractors?
So Colorshape and Orion's Forge have grossed maybe $85,000 now, which is a lot more than we expected.
Yeah.
We were thinking like maybe $4,000 each. Colorsheep is the vast majority of that, like $77,000. And something about it, we have no hard evidence In really any direction. Something about it really resonated with a lot of people. Like, it was in the New York Times, right above the crossword puzzle, shortly after launch, and Entertainment Weekly, in 4 games under $1, where it was like a Disney game, like Toy Story Smash, a racing game, like one of the big free-to-play racing games, and like one of the Temple Run games. We're like, we don't belong in this list. This is bizarre. Of course, those things don't help sales at all. But the one person it did resonate with and it mattered was this YouTuber, Vsauce3, which we hadn't heard of, didn't send him anything. But he put it in like a weekly, like all the apps that came out this week. And for some reason, maybe because Color Sheep started with C and it was earlier in the alphabet, or because he really enjoyed the idea or something, he put it first in the video and did a little extra thing where it was like a fake nature documentary. And then it's like the surprise that Sir Wilson, our sheep, fires a laser out of his mouth. And so, like, that weekend was 10,000 sales. Wow. And it was all because of him. And I think that, like, nothing else really mattered. That was, like, 2 weeks after launch. Mm-hmm. Like, we got in all the articles and whatever. And
so you need to get him your
Battle Chef. Yeah, so I think, like, largely luck. But there are elements, like, we set ourselves up to take advantage of that luck, like the art. Yeah. And the gameplay is both cute and hardcore. And we added difficulty modes to kind of support that. And so we've been really lucky, and that's been the source of our money. So we've had basically no salary for 2 years now. We paid out $7,000 of that each. And hopefully we'll do another one soon when we get our taxes figured out again.
That's right.
But so that's been our money's gone to contractors since then.
Can we talk about like the YouTube like Let's Play phenomenon for a second? Because like I don't think I truly like understood like the power of it, and then I started watching. I think it was like Shiny Rayquaza or something like that, and he was one of the first guys that got an alpha build of Risk of Rain. And you would just do, like, Risk of Rain runs. And you can see, like, the number of subscribers from when he started playing Risk of Rain to when, like, the game came out. And now he started maybe, like, you know, 100 subscribers. And he's up to, like, 100,000 or something like that. But it's... The thing about it is that it generates content by itself, right? I think about, you know, like a network like Fox, right? They have to work so hard to make great content, right? You know, like Jack Bauer runs around.
They have to work so hard to make whatever content they have.
Sure, yeah.
Let's not say that it's great or make any value judgments.
True.
I don't want to anger anyone, but honestly.
I just think of Fox because they do sink a lot of money into their dramas and their productions and stuff like that, right?
Like 24.
Right. And then here I am, and I'm just as entertained watching this one guy play, you know, this roguelike that was developed like by 5 guys, and I'm like, this is amazing that we can generate and distribute content like this. Mm-hmm. And I really think it's going to change the way that, you know, we approach marketing, that we approach, you know, the indie game scene, because, you know, a lot of people are complaining like it's not enough to be on Steam anymore. Steam used to be your ticket, right? You're on Steam, you're good. Now it's like you have to actually work to get people to like your game and your product and stuff like that.
Yeah, I think that's I wish we had like learned something from all that so far. But and like I've been trying to become more involved, like watching Twitch streams and watching some YouTubers, but like I find it really hard to work while listening to them. So like in the morning sometimes while I'm eating breakfast, I'll like watch someone playing Hearthstone or something, and it's fascinating how entertaining some of these people can be. And it's like, I'm interested in the game, but I love hearing this person talk about the game.
Yeah, it really is the personality.
And right? I think, like, that's probably an opportunity for a lot more things. Like, hearing, like, the World Cup. Mm-hmm. Why are there just, like, 2 commentators for the U.S.? Like, why wasn't it, like...
Everyone hated the U.S. commentators.
Why wasn't it just, like, you could watch this on Twitch with any of these people are broadcasting, and you just figure out over the course of the month World Cup, like, which people you enjoy listening to. And that would be fascinating. Like, you could find the people who give in-depth analysis. You could find the people who just make fun of the players all the time. Mm-hmm. You could find the commentators who just, like, talk about each of the players' personal lives or something. That's, like, tangential but hilarious if presented right. And, like, make it a whole show about it. And I feel like that aspect is missing. Like, if you just had celebrities talk about things, it can be interesting. If you had experts talk about things, that's always interesting.
I remember, like, the first time I became aware of sort of the importance of YouTubers was when the Octodad Kickstarter was happening, and people were playing the first Octodad, the sort of prequel game that they made for their university project. And I first of all, I played that game, and then I watched somebody play that game, and then I watched another person play that game. It just never got old of, like, different people's reactions to this hilarious game mechanic that they have.
Yeah, so, I think Cliffy B was saying something, like, he's starting a new studio, and he was saying that, like, the success of your game right now may depend completely on how good the YouTube videos are. You know, like, how entertaining is it to watch someone else play your game?
Yeah. And that's, like, that's probably very different than the experience playing it, which is really kind of disturbing.
Yeah.
Like, it, like,
'cause it's a different art form, like, making something that's fun to watch. It's very different from making something that's fun.
Like,
to
if
play.
You just had a whole bunch of slapstick deaths for their character, like, that might
it
be more
be
fun to watch, but it would be terrible to play, especially just, like, random events.
Yeah. I do enjoy watching Hearthstone cast, as you were saying, and half of it is just, I watched whole Biscuit do his cast, and half of it is just loving when he, like, something random happens, and he loses, like, in a turn. And it's hilarious for me, but it must be so frustrating for him to just be like, I was winning, and then I lost, you know? So it is interesting that it's two different perspectives to spectate and to actually play.
Which means that there are probably a whole bunch of, like, really great games to play out there that are just never going to get the attention they deserve.
It's definitely a possibility.
Yeah, it seems like games with shorter loops work well on YouTube, because you're not, like a JRPG... Like, who's gonna, like, you're not gonna want to pop in the middle and be like, I have no idea what's happening. You're just gonna go find, like, Hearthstone.
The Stone of Eldoroth, okay.
Yeah.
And I'm gonna watch this guy run this field back and forth.
Yeah.
Back and forth. So, speaking of Twitch, Rob, you've been streaming some development.
Yeah.
How's that been going?
Well, I basically have no viewers, but I'm hoping that will pick up over time, because I do get, like, maybe a new subscriber or two every time I stream, so people are getting alerted that I'm going up, and I'm just hoping for kind of a snowball effect. I'm also, I think that I've really got to sort of figure out a situation, like, I actually did it today, and I feel badly, like, being a big personality when I'm here working in the co-op space, because there's, like, a bunch of people trying to get their work done, and it would be a lot more entertaining if I was, like, allowed to perform a little bit more, but I don't know if there's a good way for me to do that. Maybe I should stay home on Tuesdays.
You can maybe come into this room and start screaming.
Was ist das loading? I want to play Unreal Tournament. That's a reference for those of you.
Yes,
who
yes, that's right.
Used the internet when it was in the early days. E-bombs world video of a German kid trying to play Unreal Tournament and going ape. That's pretty much. Go look it up.
Is there a good stream in terms of, like, someone you watch developing that's really interesting? I know Vlambeer streams, I think, Nuclear Throne Tuesdays and Thursdays.
Robin Arnett, I watch him do Sound Self pretty often, and Aaron Robinson doing Gravity Ghost development. I watch her, although she's, like, kind of at the end of her development cycle now, so she's been mostly using it as, like, a Q&A talk show kind of thing. But she used to just, like, code the whole time, which was fun.
I know the Indie Megabooth channel has, like, a kind of rotating... I think they're trying to get it up to daily development streams, and I've watched a couple, and one... I think the game was Mushroom 11. I forget the developer, but... He uses Unity, and he was going through his workflow and showing off some things. And there were some really cool things in there that I'm like, oh, yeah, that's a good solution to that problem that we had.
Oh, yeah, okay.
That was really rewarding.
So yeah, go ahead.
The co-op is actually going to try and figure something out. Like, we're going to try and put together a channel for all of us here in the co-op. Each of us trying to like build an audience on our own is like a bit heinous. But together, I think
you could do a really, really entertaining. There.
Even if we're just like playing other people's games.
Yeah, like when we come in here and play Mario Kart, it's pretty fun.
Mr. Ninth, right here. That's my sweet spot.
You're the one going the other
That's
way.
That's not 12th, at least.
So, you're a Unity guy. How do you like it? I know they've rolled out some new changes recently that people seem to like.
I guess the way to put it is that it's my favorite engine so far, but I hate it. I scream about it most days.
I think a lot of developers have that love-hate relationship, yeah. Right? You can't imagine using another one, but still when you're using it, you're like, oh, this is so dumb.
Yeah, one of the reasons I didn't like Wide Load in Disney was that we went through a lot of prototypes, and that meant that we went through a lot of engines, mm-hmm. which was like kind of good for me developmentally, but really frustrating. And sometimes I wish that I had more direct control. Like Unity doesn't expose a source, and you get your scripting little sandbox, but you can't do everything you might want to do. And sometimes I wish I had that control again, but other times I'm really happy that I don't have to worry about some things.
Yeah.
And so I think on the whole, it's definitely really good. And being able to build up our own like plugins and tools on top of Unity, from Colorsheep to Ryan's Forge to our canceled project codenamed Accidents to Battle Chef Brigade, that's been really powerful. Being able mm-hmm. to stick with it, and we've kept pace with all the updates. And some of the systems, like Unity 5, will have like a GUI system, a proper GUI system, and we'll have a proper audio system. And we're really looking forward to that, but we know that it always takes them a few releases to work out all the bugs.
Right, excuse me.
And so, like, Battle Chef Brigade uses full 3D physics, even though the 2D physics has kind of come online. Like, it had bugs, and you can't, like, if you're working on something, you can't just, like, accept a partial solution mm-hmm. or a partial replacement. So, that's been frustrating, and we complain, but at this point...
Shelly.
We're really confident in our ability to overcome problems, and we mm-hmm. know a lot of the solutions already.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I'm tempted every now and then to like, oh, let's try out some Unreal 4, but I know that it won't end well. That would add a lot of extra time.
Yeah, it seems a lot of games do face a lot of setbacks, and that you know it does seem so sexy to go to the new engine, and then when you get in, it's like, oh no, we solved all this stuff in the other engine, now we gotta solve it here. So I think there is something to be said for just continuity, right? Just saying like, okay, we know we're good in this, we know what the issues are, so.
Yeah. So much of it is about the community surrounding the tools too. It's not even like the actual tool.
Mm-hmm.
As you say, like UDK has a ton of, there's a ton of developers out there, but they're mostly not indies. Like, it's hard to, and a lot of their sort of knowledge is locked away behind NDAs, so Unity is
that can be problematic for the Unity for the opposite reason, like a lot of the hobbyist things, like mm-hmm. if you're looking
people
for
people do it like the
yeah,
wrong way,
if you're looking for some obscure function in Unity, trying to find some like, is this a bug or not, and you Google it or something, you're gonna find a lot of like slightly related hobbyist questions, uh-huh. and Google's like, oh, you want these? And you're like, no, I want the actual complicated version of this, and that can be a real pain.
Yeah.
But we were really lucky at Disney, we had access to the source, and so it was like, some of those things we learned, like, we know what's going on under the hood, and it's unfortunate that there's a lot of answers that are just missing from the internet, but that's what cool communities are for.
Yeah.
And so like in the co-op, we have lots of people who have had the experience, and so we can just pester them.
That's true. Yeah, it's shared brain power. Yeah. Right.
Or stack three of before. Us have different preferred game engines, which is not common.
Yeah,
to get
that's
three
true.
Yeah.
And we're all over the spectrum. It's not like you're UE4, I'm Crysis, and you're the other one is, but. I did think that move by Epic was really interesting, where they changed it to like that subscription model. Mm. Because I used to be an Unreal guy, and then, you know, this was back in the day when it was like, $300,000 to buy a license. Yeah. It's just like, this is no way this is happening. So I moved on, and now it's like, oh, maybe it's time to go back. So it is interesting that they seem to be kind of courting the indie community more.
Yeah, and I'm really glad that that's happening.
While we have a couple minutes left, can we go back to your Kickstarter for a minute?
Sure.
So do you have any plans, ideas for like backer tiers, rewards, that kind of stuff?
Yeah, so I think our guiding principles, we haven't nailed anything down, but our guiding principles are no digital, or all digital, no physical rewards. And we want to have fairly few tiers. Mm-hmm. We're trying to simplify it down. So I think the game itself, the pre-order, will be either probably $15. And then we're going to have something cool at $25. Probably that might be the game with a whole bunch of digital rewards like the soundtrack, digital art book, that sort of thing. And then maybe one at $50. And maybe a couple up there maybe. There will be different in-game cool things. Like you could be send us a picture and we'll make you a guest judge in the game. Like say what race, like what fantasy race you want to be. Like, what are you into? Magic? Are you into like steaks? What kind of things are you into?
I'm into magic steaks.
Yeah, and then we'll try to make a guest judge, because that's a pretty common thing in Food Network shows. And
a quick questionnaire of like,
yeah,
which Greek element do you associate yourself with? A, like, what's your favorite ice cream flavor? B, like,
are you Guy Fieri?
Or are you Rachel Ray?
Yeah, exactly. And so I think that might be a fun one to do. We'll have to limit that a lot, obviously. We were thinking about some, like, if there's an in-game cookbook sort of thing of recipes you've discovered, it might be, like, Pokedex, first discovered by this person, and they're a backer, so your name is in there.
That's a cool idea.
In the game.
I like that a lot.
We were, for a little bit, like, thinking about, like, something like Beef Wellington. If it was, like, Beef Sniper XXX or something, like, that might not work as well. So, but if it was just in the cookbook and not like in all the judges have to say that, then that might be okay. But we like a real cookbook would be really neat. It might have been you who suggested this, that we make a cookbook that has the in-game or similar recipes, but it has dragon and like weird fan of like unicorn meat or something, and then it has a list of substitutes. Like that would be pretty cool.
That actually be very neat. I think that's a very like cool topic.
Like you can also use lamb in place of
dragon
when necessary.
Yeah.
If all your dragons are extinct.
Yeah. We've run out of griffins. You know what to do.
Or flying plant bugs.
Yeah.
So it's interesting that for my Kickstarter at least, the $20 tier was very popular. The $50 was like my least popular. And then like the $100 was more popular than the $50. So I think there's this weird like mental thing where people are like, okay, $20 feels like I'm not committing anything. $100, like I feel like I'm a big supporter. And $50 is just kind of like meh. So it is interesting.
Yeah, like anchoring those prices seems really important. Like even if people don't really love like the $100 tier, being like expressing that you think it might be worth it to someone can be pretty powerful. Mm-hmm. And I think we'll avoid the $1 tier for that reason. That we want to anchor people at.
They can always.
Yeah, exactly.
Back if at a $1.
You can put in whatever number you want. And I saw some posts today about like putting a little Kickstarter education in your updates, being like,
oh, yeah.
Here's where, like, I think it was for like Legend of Ilya or something, where they had it like, here are some extra rewards you can just add on to any pledge. It was like, add $5 and you'll get this, or add $10 and you'll get this. And here's a little image about how to like go to your backer, manage your backing or whatever, and like change the number, hit this button, and you're good to go. And that sort of thing where like people will be like, oh, how do I pledge $1? You could do it. Shush. You could do it if you want to.
Yeah, that's an interesting take. I hadn't thought of that at all, so. Okay, so why don't we have one recurring segment that we've actually stuck with. It's called the What We're. and it's just what we've been doing in terms of, you know, stuff to inspire our games. Yeah,
nice.
And I'll start by just saying that I've been watching a lot of YouTube commentators, and I've been playing a lot of Risk of Rain and Nuclear Throne because I watch YouTube guys play it, and I'm like, this looks like fun. I think I'll try it. And then I get really frustrated when I die, you know, because they're roguelikes. But I have been having fun with them.
And when you scream in pain, no one cares.
No one can hear my
scream. It's only digital pain.
Nice. I am currently reading a really awesome series called The Merchant Princes, I believe. It's by Charles Strauss.
Oh.
And the basic premise of the series is that this genetic ability to travel between dimensions is possessed by the main character and a whole bunch of people in this alternate dimension, which is a sort of medieval place, but this clan of people who can kind of world walk, basically, have formed an awesome, like, basically mafia in our world, and they're like feudal warlords in their world. And they use that ability to smuggle drugs for profit. So, like, they'll take things from, like, Mexico through, like, on a caravan through their medieval world and then pop it into existence in New York, like, crack, and then sell it, and they're, like, can't be tracked. And right. So the first couple books are about the kind of economics of being able to do this. Like, they can only world walk with things they can carry. And so what's, like, super important, like, patents are really important to, like, bring up this other world, but only if you get them to, like, have roads and stuff so they can get cars and all sorts of things. But then later on, there's more worlds discovered, and then not only is there, like, present day and medieval, but there's also, like, other timelines where that were kind of futuristic. So it's got, like, sci-fi and this, like, fancy medieval stuff and present day, and is fascinating.
Yeah, I guess if you're trying to move like 2 tons of coke through like medieval Mexico, this is gonna be a problem, right?
Yeah, you gotta. But like, if you have guns and no one else does,
that's true.
You'll be in good shape. And I've also started Broken Age with my fiance Jen.
Okay.
And I've been like slowly trying to get her into games, and that one's been really enjoyable to play together.
Cool.
Because it's not an action game. There's no dying, but it's a really fun story and world to explore.
Yeah, someone was pointing out, like, they really wanted to share, like, Bioshock with, like, their sister. But, I mean, it's a very interesting game, but 8 minutes in, you just brutally murder somebody. And they're like, my sister is never going to go for this. So I think it's good to have
games. Yeah, you got to know your audience.
That aren't about just brutally murdering people, so.
Yeah. So I just watched the first... whatever they put up first of the Netflix series Knights of Cydonia, which is like really interesting because Netflix sponsored the creation of this basically anime series,
okay.
Which has a lot of like 3D stuff, but it's cel-shaded 3D. So some of it is fully 2D, but it's really hard to tell the difference unless they actually do camera motions. But anyway, it's almost like an anime BSG, Battlestar Galactica, because you're like on this colony ship, and there's this weird organic space monster threat that, and people launch themselves out of the colony ship in these like fighters, which, of course, because it's anime, end up being anthropomorphic robots. And you have to like stab them with a special material, and there's a lot of intrigue because, like, you know, they take one of these little creatures on board that's kind of part of the enemy, and you're not, yeah, it has like that creepy suspenseful element that BSG has.
Mm-hmm.
So I really dig that, and I'm also trying to get my wife to play games with me. And we just started playing the Walking Dead Telltale game, which I watched videos of and stuff, but never actually played before. And that's the kind of thing that she can really get sucked into because, you know, something will happen and she'll look away from her iPad for a moment to watch this event, and then, or like I'll say, "What should I do?" And then like, you know, she'll help me make a decision or whatever. It's really easy for her to drop in and out and also, like, get the gist of the whole thing. So it's almost like watching TV
right.
For her because she only has to make occasional decisions.
Well, Tom, before we wrap up, could you give us all the info so our listeners can, you know, yeah, follow the Kickstarter?
Do you have a mailing list or something? That
we do, and we've been terrible at getting people on it or really exposing it on our website. So the important things are that Trinket Studios is at trinketstudios.com, and Battle Chef Brigade, including our development blog, which is super fascinating, is battlechefbrigade.com.
Very cool.
And then we're all on the Twitters and at Trinket Studios, at Battle Chef Game.
Trinket Tom.
I'm Trinket Tom, and there's Trinket Eric and Trinket Ben.
Very good. All right, well, I'm at Kiwon Hong.
And I'm at Bobby Locks. And this has been a great episode.
Yeah, it's been really interesting. Thanks for being on, Tom.
Yeah, thank you, guys.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for tuning in the Chicago Gamepreneur Podcast. We hope you enjoyed today's show and hope you'll be back again to share more stories from Sweet Home Chicago.